This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is a WTOP original podcast.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
Disinformation sweeping the U.S.
We've seen sort of a democratization of the disinformation landscape.
Brett Schaefer is a disinformation expert with the German Marshall Fund U.S.
So you don't have to be a Russia to run a targeted disinformation campaign. You could be a few people with malign motives, and with the tools that are at people's disposals right now, you could run a pretty wide-scale disinformation campaign targeting a candidate or just the integrity of the election itself.
And guess what? A lot of people, smart people, are saying that's exactly what's happened.
Coming up on this episode from WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. For years, we've been hearing about disinformation, and many people may have simply started rolling their eyes because we hear it so much, but it's a serious problem, and there is a whole new, more dangerous element to disinformation that's emerging right now as we approach the six-month period before the 2024 presidential election. There are new tactics, new themes, new platforms, new actors. A combination of developments is unfolding that make what took place in 2016's disinformation campaign look rudimentary. Joining us is Brett Schaefer, Senior Fellow, Media and Disinformation with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, a part of the German Marshall Fund.
Brett, a couple of years ago, you and I spoke about disinformation, and I know you do a number of things, other things, including work on Russia and situations in Russia. I know you also are pretty instrumental and important with the Hamilton 2.0 program for the German Marshall Fund. I want to ask you right now at the top what your thoughts are, your viewpoint is on where we stand now in terms of the risk of disinformation as far as the United States and the election is concerned?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is when we talk about election-related mis and disinformation, it's sort of hard in the United States to determine when actually an election season starts and ends. So it's really a kind of continuous thing. I'm not sure that we've ever sort of wound down from 2020, especially with all of the debate over the legitimacy of the outcome of the election. So it has been basically like a three to four year consistent campaign that we have seen to try to undermine confidence in the integrity of election results. And what that means is it's a pretty ripe environment for those who want to escalate those information attacks or those who want to actually get involved in them. What you're dealing with is a public that has been primed for these narratives. So whether you're talking about the Russians, who are, of course, always at the sort of top of the threat list, but other nation states as well. I mean, it could be Venezuela, it could be Cuban, it could be some of the Gulf states, it could be North Korea. They all have incentives to be involved. And again, they're dealing with an audience that is ripe for that kind of manipulation. And then, of course, you've got to deal with the domestic actors. I mean, the domestic disinformation landscape has certainly gotten worse since I started this job in 2016. And AI-generated content and the ability of AI tools to scale up disinformation campaigns, especially for those who are not well-resourced, means that we've seen sort of a democratization of the disinformation landscape. So you don't have to be a Russia to run a targeted disinformation campaign. You could be a few people with malign motives, and with the tools that are at people's disposals right now, you could run a pretty wide scale disinformation campaign targeting a candidate or just the integrity of the election itself.
Brett, one of the things that we have seen in the last few months is what a couple of members of Congress have actually said on Sunday shows and in newspaper pieces, et cetera, that this disinformation that we are seeing in the U.S. right now related to U.S. politics has actually seeped into Capitol Hill. There have been allegations that, and I've spoken with several members of Congress of both parties that say this disinformation, Russian-based disinformation, has actually seeped into the U.S. Congress. What's your view on that?
There are certain narratives about Ukraine that are difficult to understand unless you understand what Russia has been pushing for a number of years. So this idea that Ukraine is filled with neo-Nazis, other very specific sort of Russian talking points that you are now seeing parroted by certain members of Congress. And so I think what Representative Turner and a few others have said is basically just identifying what everyone has seen as being reality for quite some time. I mean, it is one thing to say, I'm an isolationist. I think we should be spending money at home. I think we have domestic problems. We shouldn't be spending money overseas. That's one argument. But when you start making these specific arguments that seem to directly parallel very specific arguments made by Russia for years, it's hard not to at least suggest some sort of cross-pollination of Russian talking points into American discourse. And that's obviously concerning. And so we often see this sort of cyclical process of narratives being recycled back and forth. So you talk about the idea that we should be spending money at the southern border and not on Ukraine. That's something that originated in the US, but of course then was picked up by Russian propagandists and amplified quite heavily as a talking point through Russian state media. And then it gets recycled back in the domestic landscape, but with just a little twist to it. And so you see these narratives sort of build off each other over time. So sometimes it's hard to understand when a narrative started in the domestic space, jumped to Russia, then jumped back, or if it started in Russia, jumped to America, jumped back. But in any case, you see these narratives like bricks sort of building on top of each other in ways that are quite concerning sometimes.
We've heard a lot as well recently about laundering of disinformation. And I'm wondering if you could share an example of how that works for people to understand. Is it like laundering money?
Sure, that's the exact parallel, actually. So when we actually sort of first wrote a paper about this in 2018, I worked with someone from Treasury on it who happened to be a Ukrainian American. So he understood both the disinformation landscape, but of course the money laundering landscape. And the problem, if you're a money launderer, of course, is it's pretty easy to make money if you're selling drugs or selling illicit weapons. What's hard to do is get that money into a legitimate financial institution, like a Bank of America. Someone running a disinformation campaign has the same challenge. Easy enough to come up with a narrative, hard to get that narrative into an outlet that is credible, that your target audience actually watches and believes in. So we've seen over time this process of really trying to take narratives from the fringes of the internet or from Russian propaganda outlets and weave them into genuine, authentic, domestic American outlets. Now, there are various ways to do that. One of the ways that we've seen is actually to take an RT article, for example, a Russian propaganda article, and to have that article republished a number of different places without clear attribution. So it will be republished on a blog. It'll sometimes be republished on these sort of faux local news sites. So these sites that say they're in Little Rock or Albuquerque, but of course are not. And there's no local journalists working on them. And they're oftentimes taking Chinese state media content. They're taking Russian state media content. They're republishing it, occasionally attributing it to an American sounding author who doesn't exist, oftentimes AI generated. And so when people encounter this information online, on social media, through a web search, they're seeing it as if it is coming through an authentic American outlet, not a Russian state media outlet. And of course, that really changes how you evaluate the veracity of information. You know, Whether or not you want to believe it is up to you, but at least if you understand it's coming from a Russian state media outlet, it's a very different way you would approach that information than if you think that's a local journalist in Albuquerque running that piece of news.
Is there a way for the average news consumer to track, to walk the cat back, as the investigators might say, to figure out that this is disinformation? Because one of the things that we hear, or we've been hearing for a while from folks at CISA and U.S. investigators from the FBI is, you know, use several different sources of information to, you know, don't just rely on one thing. But when you find something like this, though, is there a way to verify?
I think the point you raised is really critical, because we have always told people you need to triangulate your information. Don't look at one source. But of course, with information laundering and with the ability, especially through AI, to republish content in a number of different places, that sort of blows up that strategy. Because if you see this information first on RT.com, you run a web search and you're seeing variations of the same information that have been republished elsewhere, it is a sort of citation cascade where you're getting all of these different sources seeming to say the same thing. They appear to be unique and individual, but they're not, in fact. And so that's actually a strategy that we have seen threat actors use when they say to audiences, you know, go and do your own research. Don't just trust me. Go run a web search. But of course, if you're filling a void with content that you have created through a bunch of different sources, it's a reinforcement mechanism. So people seem to say, or people seem to think, okay, I've seen this now from six different sources. There must be something there, without understanding, in some cases, all six sources are being run by the same entity in some cases. So it's a real problem in terms of information consumers being able to cross-check. If their attempts to cross-check, they're coming across all different sources, but are effectively republishing one narrative. And so again, this is something we've seen our foreign adversaries use, but we've seen it be a problem in the domestic space as well. There's a concept called data voids, which means there's just not a lot of content produced around a certain topic or a keyword. So if somebody searches it, a search engine can only pull from what's there and what's available. And if what's available is all being republished by the same source, or at least the same perspective, then it really reinforces the initial narrative, because people say, I did my research. I did what I was supposed to do. I went to four different sources and they're all saying the same thing without understanding. They're saying the same thing because they're effectively coming from the same place.
Well, Brett, you have been on the forefront, in the forefront of all of this learning and knowledge. And I'm wondering, do you have a fix for that problem?
I wish I did, but no, I unfortunately don't. There's definitely no single fix. I don't think there's even one or two or three fixes. We also now are in the age of AI, which is something that I didn't have to deal with when I started this work. And even 2 years ago, wasn't really something that was in the hands of the general public. Sure, there's a way to keep it, to create a deep fake if you were a skilled video editor. But now, effectively, all you have to do is understand where to go online, enter a prompt, and you could create a deep fake video. You could create AI generated text. So we have this new range of technology that we have to deal with as well. That is not to present a case that there is no reason to be optimistic. You know, we've often encountered new technologies. They get weaponized. There's a bumpy period, and then we figure it out. So my hope is that actually, as we've seen this sort of explosion of information that's difficult to source, difficult to trust, that it may bring people back around to going to trusted sources again, and to say that we actually do need a profession, the profession of journalism, to help us determine what is true and what is not. And that's not a sort of elitist perspective, I don't think. You know, there are professionals, and there are professionals who need to be able to go in and say, the provenance of this piece of information comes from here, this is an authentic video, this is not. We can't all be experts in everything. And so my hope is that as we've entered this really murky territory where it's tough to determine not only what's fact from fiction, what's real from what's AI generated, that we will again rely on journalists, we'll rely on information professionals to help us figure out this new landscape that, at least on the surface right now, is a little bit tricky to navigate.
This is a part of the reason why I enjoyed speaking to you when we talked a couple of years ago, is because you have this understanding in a layman's understanding, but also somebody who's studied and learned about this. You have that understanding as well of what the problem is and how to approach it. And you give us essentially what it is that's real, not the, you know, the hopeful solution or suggestion, but these are the facts. And these are nothing but the facts. That's a part of the reason why I appreciate talking to you then, especially today, because you brought up AI, and that was my question. The impact of AI. Just break it down.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So there's two different ways of looking at AI right now. One is with content generation. That's where a lot of the focus has been. So everybody's waiting for the Biden or the Trump deepfake, where a candidate says something they didn't say, and it can be damaging to a political campaign. You can also see AI-generated images, synthetic audio, all of these different ways of manipulating media. I'm actually less concerned about AI-generated content because it's essentially media manipulation in another form. Going back a decade or so, basic Photoshopped images or images taken out of context even. So you think of, okay, it's after the election. There's again debate about whether or not the election was valid, if there was election rigging. And I want to suggest to people that we're about to see another January 6th. I can make an AI-generated image. I can also take a real image of the actual January 6th and just change the headline. That works very well. So I'm a little bit less concerned about AI-generated content just because the sort of cheap fakes or the shallow fakes, whatever you want to call them, have worked very well. What I'm concerned about with AI is the ability to disseminate and distribute content at scale. So this goes to the laundering question from earlier. In the past, if you're trying to run a wide-scale manipulation campaign, run through multiple websites or fake accounts on social media platforms, that took some time. It took a little bit of technical skill. Now, the ability to do that at a pretty wide scale for cheap, with no real technical understanding, with no human resources, it's more or less available to anyone. And so my concern is we're just going to see greater information pollution. So somebody who has a targeted malicious narrative, it's not that they just publish it once, they could publish it 1,000 different times from all of these different looking accounts or websites, and all of them saying slightly different things. So going back to 2016, that was the bot year, right? We learned about Russian bots, the ability to take one piece of text and repeat it over and over and over in an automated fashion. Well, now you can do the same thing, except instead of the bot that's saying the same thing, they're saying variations of the same thing, but that are entirely different. And the accounts look authentic and they have different images of people who don't even exist. And you can do that at scale really efficiently for almost no cost in a short period of time. So that in the immediate is my real concern, is the sort of explosion of the generation of not necessarily false content, but of particular narratives coming from a bunch of sources that may not be credible or that may not even exist.
I think the last thing I want to ask you about is doppelganger. It never left, but I hear it's back. And I hear that it's evolved. What's your view on that?
The doppelganger thing to me is a real risk. And it's something that has gotten more attention in Europe, I think, than it has in the United States. And for those who don't quite understand what the doppelganger campaign is, instead of creating an entirely fake website, say Brett's blog that doesn't exist, doesn't appear to be credible, doesn't have an audience. You are trying to create a site that looks identical to a trusted website. So it could be a news outlet. It could be a university or an academic page. We've seen Iranian intelligence officials in the past try to essentially spoof Harvard's domain to put in a piece of content that was beneficial to them. So people who went to this website somehow, I think it was instead of like harvard.edu, it was like harvard.net. So you're effectively, you think you're going to a credible source, but you are seeing a doppelganger. You're seeing sort of a mirror image of it. But of course, the content there is different. And we've seen that in a variety of different ways you can do that. One is called typo squatting. So all of us have probably done this. We think we're going to amazon.com. We just get one letter in there wrong and we're sort of redirected to a different site. Well, bad actors use that because they know a certain percentage of people are going to type in the URL wrong. And if you do that and you land on a page that's being run by a partisan actor, a state-backed actor, you think you've landed on the real page, but now you're seeing content that, of course, is being introduced there to manipulate an audience. I mean, this goes back, honestly, decades, if not centuries, of people running fake newspapers that look identical to the real thing, but of course have content in there that isn't accurate, that is attempting to mislead. So I think it's a really concerning trend because you're not trying to get people to believe in a new site that doesn't exist. They think they've landed at a credible site, but that site is not the real authentic site.
Well, Brett, you just made me think of two more things very quickly that I want to ask you about. And one of them has just slipped out of my head, but I'll get it. But I'll ask you this other one first, and that is, how do you avoid getting bitten by disinformation? Is there a way to do that these days?
Well, I think one of the things to stress is we try to present this as if disinformation is something that affects other people. It doesn't affect us. You know, we know how to evaluate information. Everybody is vulnerable to it. Because again, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are buying into some conspiracy theory. It means you have intentionally been targeted in effectively what is a scam. So you think you're going to a certain site, it redirects you to another site. So this does not necessarily mean that you are not media literate or even digitally literate. Everybody is vulnerable. And so what we have to do is we do the best we can, of course. And so there are basic sort of digital hygiene strategies that we should all be implementing in terms of how we source information. There are the basic best practices in media and digital literacy. I think one of the things that is important is to actually understand how the information ecosystem works. So what happens when you enter a search result? There isn't a librarian there who just says, okay, I see what he's looking for. I'm going to give him the best book from my library here. That's not how search results work. And so getting a better understanding of how information is surfaced, how it's prioritized, how it can be manipulated, I think is really key, because then you don't go in sort of blindly thinking that these information systems are necessarily just working to give you the best possible information that's out there. So that's part of it. But I think the second part, again, the stress is, if you are bitten, if you find something that has entered your newsfeed that you buy into thinking it is authentic, like it happens to all of us, even the professionals in this field. So I think we also need to make it less of a sort of stigmatizing thing to have at some point bought into something that's not real. And I would like to see us get to a point where we do better at reporting out as individuals when we have been manipulated by things, because I think there is a hesitancy to do that because, you know, none of us wants to appear stupid as if we've been duped. But reporting that out in the same way that you would a financial scam would be really effective to help community members understanding the threats that are out there, because they're often very, very local. And so understanding the local threats requires local actors, local leaders to communicate what they're seeing, how they may have been manipulated. And so that, I think, would be really critical as well. There's sort of a community growth happening here, and community protection happening at the local level.
Okay, and the very last thing, absolutely, I remember that one other thing. Troll factories, do they still exist? Are they even needed now because of AI?
They still exist. The question is, if they're needed, is an open question. I think the concern is that if they exist, they're still staffed to the same level. They are now 10 times more efficient. And so you're kind of looking at Henry Ford in the assembly line here, where you might have the same number of workers, but you're producing five times as many cars. So we know Russia is still running troll factories in Africa in many cases. We know other countries are doing this as well. And so what AI has done is, sure, I mean, if they want to save some money, you could cut some staff. But if they have the same staff, they're producing a lot more. In terms of the effect of a trolling campaign on a target audience like the United States, so we look at the Internet Research Agency in 2016, is there a need to run that kind of campaign targeting the US now from the perspective of the Russians? I'm not sure if that's really necessary. I mean, I always looked at potentially the most damaging thing the Russians can do are hack and leak campaigns and these really sort of sophisticated intelligence-led operations that are then amplified by troll factories, by the information operations. But just a bunch of accounts pretending to be Americans, sort of mirroring our own dysfunction, our own division. I'm not sure how effective that is in and of itself. So whether or not they're making the same calculus and saying, you know, the Americans are doing a plenty good job fighting each other, we don't need to be running troll factories pretending to be Americans. We just need to inject a few bits of damaging information into what's already a pretty toxic national conversation, and our work is probably going to be done.
That's Brett Schaefer, Senior Fellow, Media and Disinformation with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, a part of the German Marshall Fund.
That's it for this episode of Target USA. Coming up in our next episode, Ambassador Joe Detrani was a U.S. Special Envoy to the six-party nuclear talks with North Korea back in the early 2000s.
I was told by some of my colleagues, look, their missiles are antiquated, bad engineering, etc.
But 20 years later, North Korea has submarine-launched missiles, hypersonic missiles, missiles that can be launched mobily.
How wrong we were in the past.
It's not just North Korea that's the problem. There's Russia, there's Iran, and the big problem, China.
Because that is a concern, what they're doing now with their silos.
They want to fill them with more than 1,000 new nuclear weapons in the next 5 years. And then there's this. As China, North Korea, and Iran are all either seeking or expanding their nuclear weapons stockpiles, there's talk of AI being used to control them. That's coming up on the next episode of Target USA. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about the program, send me an email. You can reach me at jgreen@wtop.com. The letter J, the color green, one word, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa. jgreen@wtop.com. Also, please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter. We're at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And if you want more national security news, you can sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the Skiff, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/email.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.